Show with me, Swinton Dobson, and him, Tim Pat. Today we discuss, does universal voting ruin family and friendships? Tim.
Are people happier if they aren't involved or pretending to be involved in the affairs of the democratic modern managerial state? We did a number of topics related to this. In particular, is voting a waste of time? Some of our listeners stated it as one of their favorite episodes. We also did it on our 100th episode. Is following politics and podcasting a waste of time as well? We also did a third episode, which I'll mention later on, which is the Moldbug versus Chomsky debate, as a hypothetical debate laid out. So you could say this is an argument against women voting, but I don't think it's more of an argument against everyone voting. By the way, in terms of internal marriage politics, having two people voting either multiplies or cancels out the voting. So, like, if the wife votes one way and the husband votes another way, it's basically -0, or if it's +2. A common analogy for sports events, it's common to compare voting elections to sports events. I mean, most, unless you're the players or the coaches, you don't really affect the outcome of the result, yet fans are very much into it. And to extend this analogy to voting here, you know, do the electors actually, any individual voter doesn't really have much of a mathematical chance at changing it. Most elections involve thousands, if not millions, if not and occasionally hundreds of millions of people. So any individual voter on a mathematical level doesn't. And who are you exactly voting for? You're voting for general electors / representatives who represent parliaments or houses which have labyrinths of rules. The people who run these in order to get elected, you need to have money or you need to have donors. And the donors, and who exactly are the donors? It's the people like the Ford Foundation, the Soroses, Open Society, the Koch brothers. Those are the people that run campaign organizations to get people voted, at least in the United States. I imagine it's similar in other places. Actually, it's probably worse in other places, which I will get to in a bit. And, you know, about the bills themselves and policies. As people like Thomas Massie point out, you know, you'll just get railroaded basically out of important committees. The bills are written, they're thousands of pages long, and so forth. And furthermore, the politicians themselves that generally run are generally quite bad, the ones that make it there. Like you get people like Nikki Haley, you get people like Macron, you get people like Liz Truss or Liz Cheney. Like these are not, you know, Hayek has the essay of why the worst get on top. I don't think, you know, you're selecting for the best people. You know, as Hans Hoppe would say, you have to be an intelligent bad guy in one of his lectures here. And furthermore, to add to this point is I think there's sort of separate societies of this for this question. So I will say nuclear armed democracies, because at least places like, let's say, South Korea, let's say the states of Eastern Europe, North Africa, East Asia, Middle East, to the extent that they are democracies, their elections get interfered with by abroad, by other powers, by NGOs, the United States, United Kingdom, and so forth. I think we should sort of isolate just to like the France, the US, the UK, we'll say, because they are all UN security powers. They all have nuclear weapons. They're all roughly independent and sovereign amongst their own borders, and so forth. So like when you see the elections that happen in these societies, does the spectacle like elections poison personal relationships, friendships, families, private businesses, and firms, and so forth? That to me is the question here that is affecting. Does that affect? Because, like, in the, you know, the 2016 and 2020 elections were, in the United States context, were quote unquote poisonous for a lot of churches, a lot of businesses, a lot of families, and a lot of other sort of, you know, small to medium sized social relationships and so forth. So, like, you know, almost everyone is probably, whether admitted or not, lost friends. Maybe they shouldn't have had those friends to begin with. But most people who probably had lost friends because they were either forced to make a position on something or they didn't say the correct thing. Because you could also say, because, like, you know, if the argument is silence is violence, if you're not saying the correct thing in a way, you're consenting to the current status quo. Now, I think the right has its own problems too, and sometimes falls into the same traps here. So my question here is, would things be better at lower levels of society if the top was done undemocratically? Now, part of this dispute is whether or not democracy is itself is a good thing, and whether or not we have democracy. The reason the Moldberg versus Chomsky debate was the hypothetical debate episode we did was to point out that both Chomsky and Moldberg agree that voters don't really have much power in the United States, as well as any like it's an oligarchy with you know, as you just described here. Now, Chomsky would say that's a bad thing. Moldberg would just be like this sort of Vilfredo Pareto disciple and say that this is just the way it is. I mean, Vilfredo Pareto wrote this, like, insanely long book. James Burnham compiled a bit of his book, Managerial Revolution and Machiavellians. But he would just – Pareto and Burnham would just say it's sort of like inevitable. Democracy, if democracy in this sort of like de Tocqueville sense ever did exist, in its current form, it's always going to degrade into this sort of technocratic, bureaucratic oligarchy. So there's no going back to it. Now, for Chomsky types, this is a problem here, because they're sort of, you know, like they're in a kind of a bind, which is why, to be fair, if they go full anarchism, they don't become social democratic, although you could just say that Chomsky is just a social democratic defender. I'm just using him as an example because I think he's a good example of what the situation is here. So my question for you, Swithin, is like, would things be better off if people just sort of like downloaded from, you know, the matrix, so to speak, like just forgot about politics? Are countries which the political system, which is basically secure, Are marriages and business relationships and personal relationships better off in this case? Swithin, what do you think of this idea, and what are your thoughts on the topic?
Well, yes, they would be better off. That's a short answer. Here's a long answer. I think an interesting way of thinking about this would be to say, let's imagine you had a genuinely sort of like democratic society. Now, I'm not necessarily mean in sort of like the idea that communists are, they consider themselves democratic because they're enacting the will of proletariat, but a case of actual voting. And what kind of system would be one where people's votes mattered? It would seem to be the case that you would have to have very small political communities, which you could say is unrealistic, but fine. You have a small political communities in which you didn't vote for a representative, but you sort of like represented yourself, and you had to go to meetings, and then various laws or edicts or changes in how the road system worked or something would be voted upon. Obviously, as well, with this kind of voting system, you'd have to have some form of government providing these services. Otherwise, it's kind of free market anarchism of some description. So that's the system that you kind of have to have. I mean, that would, if that system was to work, what you would need is every individual who is there to be very knowledgeable about every law or thing that was going to be put forth before the chamber, of which they were a member. They would have to have a good understanding of political philosophy, history, philosophy, various other things, theology as well, to be, you know, the maximally involved citizen. I think when you step back and you think about this, you go, well, that's going to be something that barely anybody is going to be capable of doing, and people don't have the time or inclination to do that. So I suppose you could then say, well, you know, we need to have more of a representative system so we can take the heat off a little bit of the individual citizen for voting himself in a chamber of some description. But again, you still get the same problems. I mean, you still need to be relatively You need to be relatively well-read and up-to-date with everything, because, well, how on earth are you going to decide on which of the candidates you're going to vote for? Otherwise, how would you know? So again, this is going to produce loads of work for anybody to actually meaningfully vote. Then I suppose you could get a system whereby, well, there is representatives and people just kind of vote. Well, it's like, well, that doesn't really seem to be sort of like the Democratic or the Republican ideal. I mean, I know there's the arguments of difference between democracy and republic. Let's leave those aside. The idea you get this informed citizen who is supposed to sort of vote, and it's simply not the case that anybody, most people, are going to be able to put the time and effort to do that. Now, I suppose you can make a case, well, you know, if you restricted the franchise to people of certain stature, then maybe you had like a traditional property holding criteria, and then maybe something else would work like that. But that's what we're talking about. Universal voting, presumably over a particular age. Although we have discussed children voting in the past. But that's what you're going to need to do. And people just aren't going to be bothered to do that. And even if they are, what will happen is they'll get it. They'll look at all this stuff and they'll vote. And then they'll realize actually they have very little influence. We shall make people feel powerless in certain respects. And then they'll resent the fact that they have spent all this time and effort in coming up to the right decision for voting. And actually, this is also a case, even if you're in a particular voting chamber and you don't have a representative, I mean, you individually, even if there's only like 500 people in there, I mean, it's one in 500 isn't very many votes. And especially a problem when you get representative who don't do what they say they'll do, and you have to deal with package deals and things rather than voting on an individual basis, issue by issue basis, sorry. People are just going to become they're just going to be angry and upset because they spent all this time to do something that makes no difference. And, you know, they're just going to be resentful of that. And then if they come across people who disagree with them, it's not just, oh, we happen to disagree on this subject matter, we can kind of live longer. No, you're on the different side, you're voting in the wrong way. And this causes clear friction. I mean, it's not the same as it is in the UK, in the US, but in the UK. But like, what I understand of what happens at Thanksgiving, it just seems to be a somewhat unpleasant debating club where people aren't actually used to the rules of debate and not making things personal and just discussing ideas. Voting has the very bad outcome that things become tribal, as opposed to being appropriately disinterested, which I think causes some of the social strife. And also as well, people would be much happier if they didn't devote themselves to following the minutiae of local politics or national politics and just did something else with their life, because they would be happier as a result, because, you know, they'd be empowered. People, you feel like what you were doing, you're improving yourself, you're looking at things you're interested in, etc. You know, that would be something that would make them overall happier. And just on, you mentioned Pareto, etc. And I do think it's the case, even if you did have democratic things, even like small churches or whatever, there's going to be certain people who are motivated to be involved and to make their opinion heard. And those are the people who are probably going to end up climbing the ladder on the voting system and become adept at convincing people that they should vote for them for various positions, so they can get on the leadership in churches or even in small clubs and things. The people who actually have the time and inclination to actually put the effort into running the organization, the people who are going to lead it, and not many people are bothered to do that. So ultimately, you're going to get the iron law of oligarchy, as Robert Michel says. Even if you did have the idealized voting system, it would only probably not be like an oligarchy if everybody was equally motivated to be informed about what they were voting on. But the fact is, people aren't, and that's just an egalitarian myth. And to that extent, you're going to get oligarchy to some extent, even in those situations. That's not to say that voting can't, in principle, be a good mechanism in certain situations. I think it probably possibly can. It seems to work reasonably well in public limited companies, although I am somewhat dubious of this form of a public limited company. And in certain circumstances, voting as a procedural method seems to make sense in clubs, etc. But you're still going to be run by an oligarchy, and the main influence that people tend to have in clubs is leaving rather than voting. And I think that's really where you want to focus. You can have more power as like a voter if you can leave rather than if you can vote.
So the anarcho-capitalist project in general, which gets very much derided by all sorts of people from the left and the right, is basically to use the market analogy. So like if I go to a restaurant or if I'm buying oil, I can read reviews, I can search products and so forth. I have the power to leave. I have the power not to buy things, unless of course it's like unless it's something. Yeah, you know, I always have the power to walk out of the store or not buy the thing on Amazon or not buy the thing on eBay. But elections are a bit different here. There's in a way skin in the game, but in a way there's no skin in the game too. Like so, like if I could choose, if I go to that restaurant and it turns out to be a good restaurant, I made a good selection. Or if I pick a job, I could go, you know, it turns out to be a well-paying job or poor-paying job or a job I'm good at, job I'm bad at. So there's always much the market. That kind of analogy here does not exist in elections, so to speak. You know, if I vote for Trump because he thinks NATO is a scam, and you know John McCain is a fake hero and stuff like that, which is actually why I voted for him, because I thought you know Vietnam was basically a conspiracy all the way down, but turns out Trump is triple vaccinated. Now he didn't invade as many countries or bomb as many countries and so forth. But even on like, things like border and things like that, like so, there's sort of a disanalogy between like what I wanted Trump to do. I mean, in a way, Jeffrey Tucker was and Ron Paul were right. Now you know because I lived in the swing state, I voted for him, and like did I bring about the war on COVID because Trump technically got Birx and Fauci and other people, which is Tucker reports and so forth. So like in that sense, it's very much different than going to a restaurant or even picking a job. Now, the social democratic leftists will say that's actually a bad thing, that you can't pick a job or you go to a restaurant like that. You know, even some of the sort of crunchier anti-capitalist right-wingers will say this, like, atomizes people. Like, you know, but, like, one thing that I like about restaurants, you can say the food's bad without, you know, I'm sort of famous in my family for, I used to, you know, like for my own mother's cooking, I would say, and she actually likes it because I would tell her how I thought the truth was, not like what one wanted to hear here. And that actually improves the cooking, so to speak. And I cook myself, and I always want people to tell me if it's terrible. I don't want them to tell me it's good just because they know me. That to me is a pernicious thing to do. So in this sense, you don't get improvement. And you actually get things worse, but through democracy versus the market mechanism here. So that would be my mechanism why I think it's bad. Now the question is, can this mechanism be pushed into other areas and away from voting? And that's why voting is bad, because there's not really a direct skin in the game relationship between the two things. So Witham, what do you make of this analysis here? I mean, this is like sort of libertarianism 101 in a way here. But the problem is when it's applied to a voting, you know, it's like a shopping cart, but sometimes the shopping cart isn't what it's stated as. And it's not even clear that, I mean, even if the elections or all the votes are tabulated entirely correctly and legitimately, I'm not saying anything otherwise, even there, like, you know, sometimes you just lose. And, you know, as Hans Hoppe and Hayek would point out, sometimes the worst ideas are the popular ideas. The worst for everyone ideas are popular for everyone. So there just seems to be a disanalogy. So, like, the people who don't vote, in a way, They're kind of, in a way they're jaded, but in a sense they're correctly jaded. And sometimes I'm envious in the sense of them, like they might have something to do, but maybe it's impossible to escape it, because the old Trotsky line of you may not be interested in voting / war, but voting / war is interested in you. So what do you make of this analogy of market versus voting, Swithin?
It is very different. What effectively you do is it's kind of like storage wars, where everyone sort of bids on these container units. They don't know what it's in, except in this thing, people claim that there's something inside this container unit, and there's like two major most popular container units, or at least representatives of the container unit. And they claim that all these things are in there. And this is a litany of different things. But you have no idea what's actually in it. And then if you vote for one that you like, well, you just get the one that the other people wanted instead. And they could just misrepresent what they did. And you've got no recourse legally or anything else. So the idea that voting is... the idea that voting is sort of like the market is absurd. I mean, I know Mises says, you know, like he talks about in the sense of democracy of the market, but I mean, and I know what he meant, you know, that the $1 spent is more sort of impactful than spending a vote, because, you know, there's an actual impact there with that on the actual product you want. And, you know, you lose money and gain the good, and the merchant gets the money. And so there's a lot more sort of incentives that are aligned there. But, you know, voting is absolutely, in reality, absolutely nothing. Nothing like that at all. Just on something else with voting. Oh, sorry, just saying to people who don't vote, they're jaded. I think kind of the people who don't really pay attention to politics much, but then kind of vote, it's kind of not really much of a problem. Well, it is insofar as they vote and they're legitimizing the system in a certain sense, although whether they are or not, it's not immediately obvious. It's the people who are sort of like the political junkie type who are really feel like, the thing is, in the absence of actual traditional religions of actual gods or God, various people have kind of taken it up as a mantle of their religion, and politics becomes a genuine sort of like religious activity. I mean that in a specific sense. I mean that. So I think religion originally comes from the word, I think it's like that which is shared, I think. And you get your tribe, your group, and it's around voting and it's around politics. And a lot of these people have absolutely no influence. I mean, even if they're in sort of like local church communities where they might actually be able to do something useful and be involved. But, you know, working and being in sort of like your local Labour Party or their Democrat or Republican group. I mean, there may be some sort of social side to it, but it doesn't seem to be doesn't produce a huge amount of virtue or happiness from the members who are there. Another aspect with universal voting, which I was just thought about before, is one of the problems societally when it comes to voting, and this is especially the case in more recent years. If you look at the professed political allegiances of men and women, women on average have become far more leftist than men have. And insofar as these women think that you need to have these social views to be an acceptable moral person, then it just means that the number of them who are likely to marry, especially relatively young, is they might get a little bit desperate when, you know, they get over the age of 30 or late 20s or something. But prior to that, you know, they'll just ignore most of the men because they're icky and bad. And this sort of like wedge of what younger men think and younger women think politically hasn't seemed to have caused as much social problems as of yet. But to the extent that the political and voting divide means that you have more single men who would otherwise prefer to be married, that is going to create an undercurrent of angry young men, which is not good for social cohesion.
There's been a few polls done on this, and whether you can trust polls, but like the in South Korea, Poland, United States, I think France, the other places they were serving, there's been a growing gap between. Now, again, what do you measure right wing? What do you measure as left wing? It's a good question. But they will say that there is a growing gender gap between and whether or not whether between the two sexes, so to speak. So that seems to be, quote unquote, interesting, should I always say. So to what then, do you think it's a good idea to like leave, to get a divorce or leave them or like disown your family or disown, leave a company because they vote the wrong way? Now, see, this in a way, maybe we're part of the problem in a sense. Because we're both somewhat politically aware here, to some extent. But there are divorces that have been incurred because one spouse voted for Trump and the other spouse voted for Hillary Clinton. This does happen, and my guess is this would not happen in a society where the elections mattered. So this is a strange problem with democracy in the sense that countries with election systems that are perceived to be open or perceived to matter. Now, again, whether they matter or not is a good question. Whether they ought to matter is a good question to hear. But whether they're perceived to matter, if one half of the marriage thinks that this is the way, the other half marriage thinks it's the other's way. Now, if it's a car or it's buying a house, like in a way, you could come up with a solution to figure out what would be the best thing. Like, so if you want, you know, there's these shows on HGTV where oftentimes they're trying to buy a new house. So oftentimes the third option will develop where, well, this house has, you know, this house is equidistant between where the both in-laws or something like that, or this house, you know. There are ways to, but with elections, there's no, like, combined with all the problems we've stated earlier, there's no real way to put this together. There's no third option. And furthermore, and this also applies to like churches. This also applies to like small to medium sized businesses and so forth here, where like, you know, like I was like small to medium sized businesses here where people, you know, like maybe not they directly get quote unquote leave because the boss supports Hillary Clinton or the boss supports Trump. But do you think organizations on this level breaking up over these things? Now you could say there are other more important things that matter, and that voting is just merely a symbolic form of it. I think in the future of the case, the idea that we'll get quote unquote cross partisan marriages is basically going to go away here. The idea that, like, so your point about religion is entirely the case here. But this just means that, in a way, classical liberalism or classical full-blown liberalism is false. The idea of, like, that people are just basically interchangeable. So that'll just basically go away. But of the ones that do, I mean, it seems like it's a bad system overall, just to, you know, to leave a church or leave a marriage over the basis of voting choices. Although you could just say that's the straw that broke the camel's back. There's, but what do you make of this line of discussions with him?
I think in most cases it would be ridiculous if that is the only issue, to leave over a voting choice. I mean, that's absurd. It's kind of like. It's like you have if you get on well with somebody, but they happen to vote for the other party, or they happen to make a joke that you find somewhat offensive. I mean, why are you unfriending them as a result of that? I mean, that's absurd. Especially if they're sort of relatively. I mean, if it's someone you don't know very well, okay, it just it's, you know, it's economizing on information, just don't deal with them. Okay, that's kind of reasonable in certain respects. But why? I mean, you if otherwise you get on quite well with them, then that's absurd to do so. And I mean, taking from like a traditional Christian perspective, I mean, the only situation in which you would sort of like disavow somebody, I always, at least this would be, I think, the appropriate interpretation, is if they profess to be a Christian, but were basically like a, well, set of Vacantist guys, manifest heresy, and or were claiming to be a Christian and were living a life of disrepute. It's like, okay, yes, in that case. But otherwise, I mean, the traditional Christian way would be, well, they're of the other religion, let's just evangelize them or proselytize. I mean, that would seem to be the appropriate response, and proselytize and evangelize in an appropriate manner, rather than just going, no, we're just going to, cast you aside. Which actually is interesting. It's almost like the... like voting the wrong way is like blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. It's the unforgivable sin. It's the only thing you can't be forgiven for. And it's just bizarre. It makes no sense. Now, you mentioned, though, you know, they won't get cross-party marriages. In a way, I actually think that's a good thing. Because it seems, I've mentioned this kind of thing before, probably, on here, is that... when you had more traditional societies, your parents knew the other families from which the son or daughter was from. And so they had some good sort of, lower time preferences of influence on marriage partners. When you get into industrialization in the modern world and you get people just getting married because they like the look of each other, and they don't consider any things like, you know, children or whatever. I mean, interestingly, that Brian Kaplan, actually produced a list of advice for his nerdy followers of how to choose a wife effectively. And he commented there, it's like he's shocked at how many people don't, couples he knows have never discussed how many children they wanted to have, even after multiple years of marriage, let alone even before being married. So to the extent that cross-party marriages are actually getting people to do more due diligence on the overall personality type, background, and whatever of their future spouse, is actually probably a good thing. Now, whether you think obviously going to lead to societal division and whatever, well, only voting keeps carrying on, because I mean, there's a whole thing. I mean, Todd Lewis always mentioned this. It's like you have all these really like upper middle class leftists who, to a large extent, live quite a sort of traditional lifestyle, by which I mean, you know, they don't have any children until they're married. Now, they may be high dual income earners, but for instance, then but specifically on their likelihood of remaining married and not being divorced is way higher than many of like professed sort of right-wing lower income types. So there are certain ways in which even the people who profess left are actually very right-wing. And of course, you always get the white flight stuff, you know, oh, we're going to move to a nice neighborhood, the white neighborhood. Which is quite funny, because I taught a Pakistani student once, and he's relatives of his dad owned a business, and they moved into basically a white area around Birmingham. And then loads of brown people, in his words, turned up. So they left and went to a white area again, which was quite amusing. He was quite wide-eyed and clear-headed. But yeah, go on, Tim.
Do you think countries that have obviously unfree voting systems, or voting systems that are perceived to be corrupt, do you think the internal lives of the citizens are quote-unquote better off, at least on the sort of lower levels, than in countries where the elections and systems are perceived to be quote unquote open? So I could list places like Iran, I could list places like Saudi Arabia, I could even list places like Mexico or Argentina. They're more like middle-income countries. I could list places like Croatia or some of the Eastern European countries, which, you know, do you think on a lower level, do you think – now, it could be that these places are more quote-unquote corrupt. It could be that, you know, these places are more quote-unquote they have more, you know – there's petty corruption, petty all sorts of abuses. That could be the case here, but you know, now we're sort of we're not comparing to, you know, utopian ideals. What we're really comparing is to, you know, it's sort of like it's a beauty contest between we're seeing clearly through the rhetoric part of it. We're unmasking the one system somewhat, some of the errors of the one system here. And since most of our listeners are from United States, United Kingdom, we also get some amount of listeners from Germany and Australia and Canada based on our view, which is not a surprise. It's roughly where I would expect our audience to come from. This is more of a way to think about, like, one of the benefits of Moldbug's advice. I know there's errors in Moldbug too, but he says view the current government like you would, like if you were traveling or you're an expat. Like if you lived in Saudi Arabia, for example, you wouldn't really take a religious viewpoint of the MBS. Now there might be problems to that, because I do think the United States, in lesser extent Britain and France, they do in some ways matter, in the sense that like it could be that American voters do in a way affect the whole world. So maybe Americans do have some sort of duty to care, or on some level. That sounds like excessively soppy and possibly progressive in a way. But there could be that case. But back to my earlier question, do you think people on lower levels of society are quote unquote better off if there wasn't quote unquote open perceived to be open election systems? Swithin, what would you make of that question here? I mean, you brought up a commenter once that thought that people in Iran were actually quite well off, at least on a social level. So Swithin, what would you respond to that?
Yes, I think they are. I mean, the only argument against that really is to make the case that voting works and you make an influence. And it's clear that in almost all circumstances, you don't. Maybe there are some exceptions to that. So an interesting one for that would probably be the EU referendum in 2016 in England, because it had a massive turnover. People who otherwise just don't vote voted, because they very much dislike the EU. The people who voted otherwise didn't. It seemed to make a difference. That said, the actual relationship the UK has with the EU now is not hugely dissimilar to being actually in it. And so actually the end result probably hasn't made that much difference. Except, of course, we can't blame the EU for stuff now. So I suppose that's a long-term sort of influence that can be different. The main thing it did really, rather than changing anything, was just put the brakes on the government doing very much for two or three years, because they were just trying to sort quote-unquote Brexit out. So it seems to be that the only real thing that voting can do is sort of throw a spanner in the works to some extent, rather than being particularly constructive. And so, yeah, to the extent, and I think it's clear that voting makes very little difference at all. I suppose you might make a case for spoiling ballot papers or something. That might be worthwhile. But of course, spoiling ballot papers requires very little effort. It's, you don't need to keep to take your politics at all. You literally just turn up and spoil a ballot paper. The argument for that is in England at least, they count them and they're read out and they're recorded. And so if it was the case that none of the above or the spoiled ballot papers were greater than everybody else, then that might harm the legitimacy of the system. So you could have more times like Nikki Haley being beaten by nobody, literally. But yeah, I mean, otherwise, I mean, you've just got people spending time researching and looking at stuff that will make no difference to whatever actually happens. So unless you're actually in a position where you're in policy-making circles, you're of particular high social status, you're in a certain appropriate sort of groups or universities or whatever, then there simply is no point. Yeah, you're much better off. I think, for instance, my personal, this is a sample size of one, an anecdote, I'm much happier not reading the news. I got particularly agitated and fed up of it during lockdown. I was like, this is just so absurd in the way things are reported. I just can't be bothered. And then I recently follow various different YouTube channels and various things come up in there in the news and sometimes listen to it, but otherwise I just ignore it. And I can follow my own interests. I think I'm better. I'm happier. I can look at other things. I can read more theology, read more Bible. I can read more philosophy. I can do more things that are more pertinent to me and influencing in my life. And being a political junkie is it's not good. It makes your life worse.
I would think I would tend to agree here. I think the way to get out of the one accusation you could make is that in a sense what we're doing is the very thing we claim we're not doing. But I'm not really, we're not really, we've been we've done an episode on like Jeffrey Tucker. Is Jeffrey Tucker right about Trump? We've also done an episode, are the libertarians for Trump right? So I think we've, like, on that one issue, I think we've fairly laid out, at least from a right libertarian or some sort of non-centrist lean position, both sides of like the debate there. I mean, I don't think we have a religious devotion to either for or against them. And as far as the other issues are concerned in voting, just to avoid the ad hominem critique, which I do take somewhat seriously, that I am doing the very thing that I claim not to be doing here. If you're getting paid to do something, then things get interesting. So I do think if you join a political organization or you're a quote unquote activist and you're getting paid to do it, then things get interesting here. I mean, you could go after the whole idea of doing this as itself as a problem. But then I think you're more, even if you're a slight egoist, and I think the sort of egoist, as far as Christianity is concerned, I think egoist Christians it's about saving you, it's not about saving the community. Now, by definition, that should be against your goal, but it's about you to some extent, you individual. Now, this is a very anti-Catholic position in some way. It's not a corporate position. But I do think that politics is like the worst version of collectivism. But I do think in modern society, what we're oftentimes left with is you and the state, that there's no internal relations. I think one of the problems with politics is it actually just ruins, you know, like local clubs and other organizations, which quote unquote get political, and people either join or not join. So that's part of why, like, I wanted to do this episode here, because I heard someone who was in England, this Paul Vanderclay interviewed, and I just like, I wish you just never mentioned her views on Trump. Like, they were just, like, you're not even in the United States, you're 4,000 miles away. I mean, you should just take this sort of idea seriously that they don't care about you, either the parties don't care about you, and take that seriously. That'd be my overall comments regarding this. And to escape the ad hominem critique that I am a political junkie, which I don't think maybe I am to some extent, but I don't think in the pernicious way. And I've identified to some extent this is a problem here, so which is why I did this episode too. So would people be happier overall if they wouldn't care about electoral politics? I think yes, but I do think there are qualifications to that. And there's some extent always like, what's the alternative here? Are people overall happier in Iran or I don't know, Eastern Europe? That then you're getting into real debate over, you know, what would an ideal society look like, and what would be the ideal political system. Now, our ideal political system is no political system. It's an operative of capitalism. It's choosing political what is now known as political questions in the same way as David Friedman would say you choose restaurants or choose houses, like, or cars. Like, you have private property, you have contracts, you think about the merits and dismerits of any individual thing, and you go forward. Minarchists, of course, think, as Kinsella would make fun of them, would think only important things should be decided by, only unimportant things should be decided by market. Really important things like law, order, and things like, and healthcare and education, they should be decided by the government. That's what Kinsella is good at making jokes about minarchists in this regard. So that would be my overall comments about the voting system and its alternatives. Thanks for doing this episode, Swithin, and if you have any more comments, please go ahead. But that's it for me.
I don't think we're political junkies. The political junkie is the one who is always up to date with all the latest news from the Capitol and is always very concerned about voting. That's certainly something we're not doing. You could argue that we're like political philosophy junkies, but I think that's very different. I would liken sort of being a genuine sort of political electoral politic junkie to basically somebody who's just constantly eating like sweets or candy. I mean, it's just not good for you, and you just got to get more and more and get the hit. Whereas I like to think of political philosophy junkies as eating various different types of steak. Well, you know, there's rump here, there's ribeye there, T-bone there. That's really what we're doing. And we never really advocated anyone vote for anybody in particular. I mean, you could say, you know, why are we doing this? And we did an episode as to why we did it. But it's just because we think it's interesting. I mean, even if we made no difference, I enjoy doing this. I think it's an interesting thing. You're learning more about the world. And if we do have any influence, I think the way I would look at it is the influence we have is, well, somebody who might end up being in an elite of some description of society or semi-elite can influence this person, and they might change what they do accordingly. It's certainly not a goal of mass conversion of people, because, I mean, even if we were on mainstream television doing this, I doubt our viewing figures are particularly high, even if we look better and a little bit more professional at what we did and look well. I mean, this is not something that most people would be interested in. So, I mean, that's how I would distinguish ourselves from Fox News, CNN, GB News, etc. And just an aside, I mean, watching news television for more than 5 minutes is so infuriating. I just have to turn it off. It's so bad, and it irritates me so much that you learn absolutely nothing. It's just bombastic, empty rhetoric from everybody all the time. You know exactly what they're going to say. There's no new ideas and no thing. Oh, I hadn't really come across that form of Marxism before, or something like that. No, nothing at all. It's so predictable. And so dull. It's just appalling, and I'm sad that people think it's good for them, but it clearly isn't. It's a part of the false civic religion built up around the mystique of a democratic society, and yeah, it's not good. Anyway, and I'd like to thank you for listening. If you'd enjoyed this podcast, please share, and subscribe. The more subscribers we get, the higher we get in the search rankings, and the more people can access this material. And if you'd like to contact the show for any reason at all, please contact us at mindcryinglibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcryinglibertyshow@gmail.com. We'll be right back.